This is Audible.
These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. The Great Courses cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the Teaching Company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. These lectures are titled The History of Ancient Rome, Part 1. The lecturer is Professor Garrett G. Fagan. Professor Fagan is an associate professor in the Department of Classics and Ancient Mediterranean Studies at the Pennsylvania State University. A native of Dublin, Ireland, he earned his BA and master's degree at Trinity College Dublin and received his PhD in Roman Studies at McMaster University. He was a Killam postdoctoral fellow at the University of British Columbia, Vancouver. Before joining the faculty at Penn State, Professor Fagan held teaching posts at McMaster University, York University in Canada, and at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Professor Fagan's main research interest is Roman social history. His articles have appeared in international scholarly journals, and he is the author of Bathing in Public in the Roman World. Professor Fagan prepared the course guide that comes with these lectures. The course guide includes a detailed outline of each lecture, timeline, glossary, biographical notes, and bibliography. To get the most out of this course, you may find it useful to follow along with the outlines or review them before or after each lecture. Lecture 1, Introduction.
Hello, and welcome to the Teaching Company's course on the history of ancient Rome. My name is Garrett Fagan from the Pennsylvania State University, where I teach Latin, Roman history, and Roman civilization, and I'll be your guide for the next 48 lectures as we survey the sprawling, majestic, complex, I'll be straightforward and say that up front, and occasionally somewhat frightening history of the longest-lived and largest empire mainland Europe has seen. For this and the next lecture, before we embark on the details of the history of Rome, I want to introduce you to the subject, address some very basic issues in this, the first lecture, and the next lecture, introduce you to the nature of the evidence for ancient history. To begin with, however, I think we should start very much at the beginning and answer a question that's always been asked of me. Why bother? Why bother studying the history of ancient Rome? Then we will look at the parameters of the course. We will set the limits of our study, the thematic focuses of the course, the chronological and geographic focuses of the course. And then I will end this lecture, finally, with some personal thoughts on the nature of ancient history specifically, and how it differs from what most people in the public consider to be typical history. So that's the outline of this lecture. First of all, why study ancient Rome at all? I'm often asked that, most recently about 3 days ago. Someone said, what do you do? I said, oh, I teach ancient history. Why? You know, it pays well. Isn't really the good answer. What is the reason for studying the ancient world, and specifically Rome? Well, I believe the answer to that is quite complicated, and again, it's a very personal answer. Different people will give you different answers to this question. But I think the overwhelming reason is that Rome has exerted a continuous and profound influence on the history of not just Europe, but of the Western world, because of the dominance of the Western world in the global forum of the whole world. The heritage of ancient Rome is vast, and I will give you just one example from the complicated mosaic of how this heritage has been transferred to us. This is the Grand Tour, the so-called Grand Tour that was very popular in the Renaissance, right through to the 19th century, but especially popular among British noblemen, noble youths, especially men, in the 18th century. The Grand Tour was a prerequisite for the educated man, who had, of course, already read his Latin and Greek in school, and perhaps in universities. And the Grand Tour involved travelling over to the continent from England, usually, beginning at Paris, and then with no set itinerary moving through the great cultural centres of Europe. But the destination was invariably always Rome. You could add in Florence and Naples, because in the 18th century at this time, Pompeii was just being discovered and excavated in a very systematic way. So Naples was also a popular destination, but for Roman reasons. And of course, Venice was also a popular spot, but the ultimate destination was invariably Rome. At any one time, there could be hundreds of Englishmen traversing the continent on their way looking at all the ancient monuments. In 1786, for instance, Sir John Fleming Lester noted that Rome was, quote, perfectly filled with English, unquote. And Edward Gibbon was prompted to write his vast and magisterial study, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, whilst sitting on the Capitoline Hill in Rome on the Grand Tour as a young man in 1764. Well, the direct way that the ancient world came into the modern through these Grand Tours is self-evident. When these people came back from Italy and from Rome, they brought with them the sensibilities of the ancient world. They liked to decorate their houses, or build them even in neoclassical styles. They liked to surround themselves either with genuine ancient artifacts or with fakes. And of course, in the poetry they wrote, the literature they wrote, they reproduced ancient Roman sensibilities again and again. Direct cultural influence through the Grand Tour. But that's only one tiny tessera of the larger mosaic. In fact, if we look around us in the modern world, the face of Rome is everywhere to be seen, as long as you know where to look and how to identify it when you look there. For instance, the Romans have given us two major models of government. A republic, a balanced republic involving usually a limited enfranchised body of citizens who elect members of a council that also has an executive branch of officers answerable to that council who carry out the orders of the council. That is a Roman model of government. The other model, which is not, of course, popular on this side of the Atlantic, but has been very popular in Europe and is still around in certain places, is a monarchy. But a monarchy tempered by law and tradition, and also a monarchy answerable to councils and the public. And another form of government that has died out since, but was very popular and very common in Europe for many centuries, was absolute monarchy. All of these are Roman models. In the case of the United States of America, for instance, the founders were unequivocally and directly influenced by their knowledge of the ancient Roman past in formulating the Constitution. In fact, recent books on the subject have emerged that bring this out absolutely clearly. One published in 1995 is called The Founders and the Classics, and shows not just how the polity of the USA has been influenced by ancient Rome, but how attitudes towards pastoralism, agriculture, the place of the citizen in the state, and so forth, were all informed by the founders' knowledge of the classics, and particularly of the Roman classics. Another feature of the Roman world that we inherit and take for granted is our reverence for the law. The Romans loved the law. They conceived of the law somewhat differently from the way we do. It wasn't a law of individual human rights, the way our modern law is. But the notion that the law stands above us all, that the law is something to which all of us are answerable, including the members of the government, that is a Roman concept. The Romans also were very profligate by ancient standards with their citizenship, which is another feature certainly of America if we think about it, how many different people can come and become citizens of America. The notion of a universal citizenship, that is a Roman notion. In fact, we could say, in all fairness, that the very notion of the West is founded on a memory of ancient Rome. Europe has pretty much always seen, until the last century, some form of the Holy Roman Empire, although in Voltaire's words it was neither holy, nor Roman, nor an empire. But the very idea that people would call a political entity in Europe a Roman Empire shows the power of the memory of Rome, which I think arguably stands at the foundation of our concept of the West as a cultural and political entity. And in more everyday ways, we see Rome all around us, in our art and architecture, especially large public buildings. The Capitol in Washington comes immediately to mind. This is a Roman building. Some people may think it's Greek, but they're speaking from architectural ignorance. This is a Roman building. The Greeks didn't have domes. Romans were the ones who developed concrete, and so were able to develop curvilinear forms of architecture, which they, to be sure, encased in Greek classical forms, in columns, in marble, and so forth. And this is very much a neoclassical, but very much a Roman model of public architecture. If we look at ancient temples, ancient Roman temples, and compare them to, say, the Supreme Court building, the influence is crystal clear and doesn't need really to be built upon. Or if we take a very specific form of Roman building, the Triumphal Arch, which was really a monument of personal egotism, built by successful generals and eventually emperors. And then look at the Arc de Triomphe in Paris, one of the major monuments of Paris, built by, yes, an egoistic individual. Then we can see that the architectural and artistic heritage continues. This is just in the form of architecture. I haven't mentioned sculpture, painting and so forth, all of which have governed, or at least greatly exercised an influence on the forms of Western art and cultural achievement. But by far the most direct descendant of ancient Rome is the Catholic Church. Because, in fact, the Catholic Church is in many ways the son of Rome. It is the Roman Empire made manifest in the modern world. It has an absolute emperor in the form of the Pope. The Pope is called the Supreme Pontiff. Why? Have you ever wondered why he's called the Supreme Pontiff? Well, because the ancient Roman chief priest was called the Pontifex Maximus, which means the Supreme Pontiff. Why? Well, that's a different matter. Maybe we'll get to that when we look at Roman paganism later in the course. But the very title and nature of the papacy is modelled on the ancient Roman Empire. Where does the Pope live? He lives in Rome. He lives in Rome surrounded by neoclassical buildings. He has around him a council, if you like, of cardinals, whom, like ancient emperors, would send out governors to the provinces, he sends out to govern specific regions of the Catholic world. And those governors have under them a series of underlings going down to the parish priest who help them administer the Catholic world. This resemblance between the Roman Empire and the Catholic Church is not coincidence. As we'll see later in the course when we look at the rise of Christianity, one of the reasons for the success of the Christian Church was precisely its modelling, its conscious modelling of its organisation on the secular Roman government of the empire. So much then for some of the influences, and I've just scratched on the surface, there are many more that we could talk about, that have come down to us from the ancient world, and specifically from ancient Rome. But there are other reasons, I think, why it's worth studying Roman history. There's no doubt that in the popular image, there are certain powerful themes, images in the mind that can spring to mind when one thinks of ancient Rome and are still obviously something that resonate with us. Caesar murdered as he comes into the Senate House. Nero fiddling while Rome burns. Gladiators fighting to the death on the sand in front of ravening crowds. Chariot races. Decadence and orgies. These are all images that come to mind of ancient Rome, and they can be found reproduced in popular culture either directly or indirectly again and again. I heard recently an excellent paper which showed that themes drawn from Roman history have infused many science fiction TV and movie depictions, particularly the image of bread and circuses, the notion of a manipulative government that sort of keeps the populace docile through violent entertainment, manifested in various Star Trek episodes and movies like Rollerball and so forth. These are all themes that are familiar to us. They can be sort of rehoused, recast, and represented to us in recent science fiction, but they're all drawn from the Roman world. Yet another rather more mundane reason for studying Roman history is that it's just really interesting. The Roman Empire was extremely large, stretched from Syria to Scotland, from the Black Sea to the Atlantic Ocean, spanning three continents. It was extremely long-lived, as empires go, 500 years, which is really quite a remarkable achievement, how the empire survived so long. But more than anything else, during that long period of time, over that great expanse of land, it changed enormously. Unlike many ancient states, which tended to be fairly static, the Roman Empire changed socially, politically, culturally, again and again. It reinvented itself, to use a modern term, repeatedly. It changed from being a monarchy to being a republic, back to being a monarchy, and ultimately to being a divinely legitimated monarchy, rather on the model of a medieval monarchy. Just that process, just that political process is fascinating to trace, the way the Romans adapted and changed themselves to fit new circumstances. Culturally, it changed from a very basic, rustic, simple society to a highly sophisticated, urbanized, Hellenized society. By Hellenized, I mean influenced by the Greeks, and we'll be looking at that in some detail later in the course. So the long period of Rome's survival, when coupled with the success of the empire, and when coupled with the way it changed over times, I think makes for the study of ancient Rome to be a very, very interesting and fascinating subject in and of itself. Well, I hope that answers the question why. I think I've just advanced, as I say, some personal reasons why I believe the study of the ancient world is so valuable, and the study of ancient Rome in particular. And what I want to do now is set the parameters for the course to focus on what we will be looking at, and I suppose, just as importantly, what we will not be looking at over the course of the coming lectures. When you do the history of any subject, especially one as vast as ancient Rome, we're covering maybe 1,500 years of history here, there are so many things that could be looked at that we're going to have to cut and paste, if you like, and focus on certain things to the detriment of others. I believe that the political and military history of Rome is the core of the subject, and we will be looking at that in no uncertain way. We will be focusing on the development of the Roman state along the lines I have just mentioned, and we'll be looking at the rise and maintenance and eventually the fall of the Roman Empire in the West. We will also look at some, I suppose, what can be described as broadly social historical issues. What was Roman society like? What was it like to live there? What were the Roman social attitudes like? What were their families like? Why did they have slaves, and what was the life of the slave like? What did they do for entertainment and relaxation? What were their religious beliefs like? Why did Christianity emerge as the dominant religion of the Roman Empire? Under what circumstances did that happen? After years of persecution, how did Christianity emerge out of the sort of roiling mass of religions that made up the Roman Empire? Those sorts of social, historical, cultural issues are something that we will be looking at as well. What we will not be looking at, unfortunately, are artistic and cultural matters in any great detail. I've just talked about Roman architecture and its influence on monumental, especially public, secular architecture of the modern era, but that's something that we will not have time to look at. It's really a subject in and of itself. A course in Roman art history would be something that could occupy easily 48 lectures without any difficulty. Likewise, we won't have much time to look at matters literary. The rise, development, and nature of Roman literature is not something that we look at in detail. We will, of course, have to address authors. We will look at certain authors who are important for historical reasons and as sources for the ancient world, but we will not have time to examine the course of Roman literature, the history of Roman literature in and of itself. That's something that we'll have to leave to aside. So similar issues like that. Cultural issues really are something that we will perfunctorily look at, but we're not going to be able to examine in any great detail. Second, chronological parameters. What are we going to set by way of chronological limits on the course? I suppose technically ancient Rome starts around 1000 BC, and technically, if we include the Byzantine Empire, which was the Eastern Roman Empire, which survived after the fall of the Western Empire, it technically ends in AD 1454. No, we're not going to cover all that territory. It would simply be impossible. The main focus of the course will be up until the collapse of the Roman Empire in the West, which is traditionally dated to AD 476. But I'll be even more specific. We will actually focus especially on what's often called the central period of Roman history, that period which stretches from about 300 BC to AD 300. The reason I'm setting those limits is that the study of late antiquity, of the period of the Christianized Roman Empire, is an immensely complicated one. And it's worthy of a course in and of itself. In the view of many modern scholars, late antiquity bleeds into medieval Europe. And we're not going to take the story down to the medieval period. So our chronological limits then once more will be roughly focusing on the period 300 BC to AD 300. But we will of course look at the early Roman period. I will cover the issue of late antiquity and the fall of the Roman Empire, but I'll do so in less detail than I will the really central core period of classical Roman history. In geographic terms, we will follow the rise of the Roman Empire from a small hamlet of shepherd huts overlooking the River Tiber in Italy to a colossus that bestrode the then known civilized world. So our geographic parameters will basically be dictated by the activities of the Romans themselves, which were really quite energetic, as we'll see. I want to end the lecture with some very personal thoughts again on the nature of ancient history and introduce the themes and methods and approaches of ancient historical research, which in the view of many differ in significant ways from what most people consider typical history. If one was to be guided by what history is by looking at television, one would be convinced that history is Hitler, basically, because he seems to show up every time there's a history show. We get Hitler or World War II are generally more recent events. It's not hard to see why, of course, television requires moving pictures, and it's only in the more recent history that we have those available to us. But the study of modern history is indeed something which has a very set quorum of methods to it. And ancient history, of course, shares many of those methods with modern history, but with some significant differences. Firstly, to make a sweeping generalization, what is history? Well, history is, I suppose, broadly speaking, a two-part process. It's the assemblage of facts about the past. That's part one. Part two is it's the interpretation of those facts. It's all well and good to know that the Battle of the Somme started on the 1st of July 1916, but what's the meaning of the Battle of the Somme? Why is it important? Why should we know that? Why should we look at it at all? That's the issue of interpretation. Now, ancient history is, of course, like all history, pretty much in its broad outline of that shape. You assemble facts and you try to interpret them. But the biggest difference between ancient history and the study of more recent periods is the problem of the evidence. I'm going to devote the whole next lecture to the issue of what the ancient evidence is. But right now, let me just introduce you to the problem and outline the sorts of limits it places on our knowledge and the way ancient history is done. If you were to write or attempt to write a history of the US Congress as a single individual, in which you incorporated the development of the physical environment in which the Congress appeared, the constitution of the Congress, every statute that was ever put out by the Congress during its history, the relationship of the Congress to every president who's ever been sitting, the various influential individual congressmen and senators who have sat at one time or other in the US Congress, you would be facing an impossible task. The volume of material you would have available to you would make it impossible for one person to do that. But because in the ancient world there's a limited body of material, it is possible to write a book with the title The Senate of Imperial Rome, or The Magistrates of the Roman Republic, covering 500 years of history in a single or maybe a two-volume work. It is possible for one person to master the evidence because there's a limited body of ancient data. And that is the single greatest difference between the study of ancient history and the study of more recent periods. The body of ancient material is finite. It's mostly pretty well known. It has been known for most of its history, or at least for most of the history of the scholarship on the ancient world. It's also patchy and often contradictory. And this makes for the study of the ancient world, well, it makes it a very difficult and challenging business. I'll give you an example. It's estimated that of all the literature that was written by the Greeks and Romans combined, of all the stuff that was originally out there, maybe in the Library of Alexandria or in the great libraries in Rome, of all that material, less than 5% has survived. We have less than 5% of the literature that was originally out there. We have authors that we don't even know existed. We have authors, we know the names of them. We might know what they wrote about, but we don't know anything else about them. Some authors survive almost entirely. Some authors survive in various percentages of their work survive completely, or they survive in summaries written by later writers. So there's a patchy, shifting, I suppose, body of material. Very, very difficult to master it. I've heard it said, I really like this analogy, I can't remember where I came across it, but I've heard it said that studying the ancient world is like looking into the palace at Versailles through keyholes. You're able to see certain things extremely clearly, other things are a bit blurry at the edges of your keyhole view, and there are whole wings that you simply can't see. There are whole floors and wings and levels of the palace that we can't see. There are areas of the ancient world that are inaccessible to us by the nature of the evidence that we have presented to us, or that has survived over the intervening centuries. This makes the establishment of the facts in ancient history often a lot more difficult than it is in more modern periods. No one really doubts that the Second World War started when it did. People know the exact minute when John F. Kennedy finally passed away, and so on. But establishing fundamental facts like that in the ancient world and in the study of Rome is often very difficult. We do know, for instance, that Caesar was killed on the 15th of March in 44 BC. But other things are far less clear to us. The order of events is often a matter of tremendous debate. To take just an example, the issue, the breakout of the Second Punic War, which we look at in more detail later in the course, is a matter of some discussion. This was a war that almost eliminated Rome from the face of the planet, because the Carthaginian general was a man called Hannibal. And this war started actually in Spain. And it started over a dispute about a rather inconsequential place in Spain called Saguntum. And it's a matter of tremendous debate about the nature of Roman-Carthaginian relations in the lead-up to the dispute over Saguntum. What was the nature of the agreement about the spheres of influence in Spain between Rome and Carthage? When was that agreement reached? Where did Saguntum fit into that agreement? And when did the Romans establish a friendship with Saguntum that allowed them ultimately to side with this place and start a war with Carthage? Not that the Romans started the war, but it was the spark that ignited this massive conflict. All of those basic facts, fundamental facts, as to the start of this absolutely titanic struggle between these great states are all matters of debate. They're not matters of certainty. And this leads us to, I suppose, the next major facet of ancient historical inquiry. That is, because of the limited body of evidence, the scope of interpretation by modern scholars is far broader for the study of the ancient world than it is for the modern. I'm not saying that modern historians are all in one big happy agreement, sitting around in a rose garden, eating lollipops and saying how they all agree with each other. Far from it, of course not. But the sorts of things that they argue about are so much more, I suppose, marginal by the values or by the standards of the ancient historian that there is a big, big difference there. Interpretation in the study of the ancient world is far broader than it is for the study of the modern world. And this leads to what I've termed the absence of certainty. As I say, there are certain things that we know. Remember the keyhole image. We can see through the keyhole into certain parts of the palace, but there are whole areas of the palace that we cannot see. Certainty is very much the rare bird of the study of ancient Rome. There are certain things that we can absolutely say with confidence if the ancient evidence is focused on those things. Again, I'm leading into the next lecture here a little bit, but this is what we'll be seeing the next time around. More often than not, what you have in the study of ancient Rome and the history of ancient Rome are competing reconstructions, competing models to explain the events that we have preserved for us in the ancient evidence. This means that there are few correct, definitely correct answers that can be given to very many fairly fundamental questions about the facts of the ancient Roman world. I don't want to oversimplify here, but there are certainly issues that remain a matter of tremendous discussion and tremendous debate, fundamental issues that are forced upon the ancient historian, the modern ancient historian looking at the ancient world, by the nature of the evidence. The primary evidence is again what we're coming back to again and again and again, and that's what we're going to look at in the next lecture.
Thank you.
Lecture 2, The Sources.
Hello and welcome to the second lecture in the history of Rome for the teaching company. This is the second of the introductory lectures, and I want to pick up where I left off last time, where I was discussing the nature of ancient history, and I stressed at the end of the last lecture the importance of the ancient evidence and how the limited, finite nature of the ancient evidence defines the whole discipline of the study of the ancient world. What I want to do in this lecture is expand on that theme and outline in some detail the nature of the ancient materials. And I also want to outline to you some approaches that are taken, differing approaches that have been adopted over the years by modern scholars using this ancient material. All history is based on what are called the primary sources. The primary sources can be broadly defined as those that derive from the period under study. They can vary in terms of their focus and in terms of their quality. And in a period as long as the history of Rome, they can be far removed chronologically from what they're writing about. We can have the likes of Plutarch, a Greek and Roman, of course, of the 2nd century AD, writing about King Romulus, who lived 900 years previously. So the question could be asked, to what extent is he a primary source at all? What does he know about Romulus? Well, that's a good question, and the point in defense of classifying Plutarch, no matter what he's writing about in the ancient world, as a primary source is that he is a member of the ancient world. He is an ancient Roman who thought, lived, and experienced antiquity in a way that no amount of research by a modern scholar such as myself could ever hope to replicate. So the primary sources then, in the broadest definition, are those sources that derive from the period under study, even if they themselves are focusing on eras or subjects far removed chronologically from the lifetime of the author in question. If we have primary sources, you won't be surprised to hear that we also have secondary sources. And secondary sources are modern works, works by modern scholars who are reconstructing, assembling, and interpreting the ancient data to write a subject such as the Senate of Imperial Rome or the life of Julius Caesar or whatever. It's important to stress that these sources are literally secondary. They are all grounded in the primary evidence. If there was no primary evidence, there was no ancient evidence, there would be no secondary scholarship. Before looking at the nature of the primary sources, I believe it's important to assess quickly some of the differing approaches that have been taken to interpreting the ancient data over the years. Looking particularly at history writing, the writing of ancient history as an art, or as some might argue, as a science. In its original form, history writing was really more an act of literature. This is how it was for the ancients themselves. They were concerned, of course, to find out the truth about the past, about their own past and the past of whoever they were studying. But their works of history were really works of literature. And this tradition was very long-lived, up to and including, I would suggest, Edward Gibbon's The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, which can be studied as much today as a work of literature, as a work of history. It is a good work of history, but it's very literary in its approach. In the course of the 19th century, especially in Germany, history became more scientific, and I use quotation marks there, because there's a big question as to whether history is scientific at all, or whether it's just an art form. But in the 19th century, certainly historians, especially historians of Rome and the classical past, began to take a more scientific approach to the study of the past. And there broadly emerged an approach which has been called positivism. Positivism is the assembling of every available piece of ancient data about the subject under study. And in fact, it's no coincidence that it's at this very period in the 19th century that the great collections of, say, Latin inscriptions began. Some of them are still ongoing. The assembling of every Latin inscription that we know about has been published gradually over the years since the 19th century. Why? Because the positivists demand that all the evidence be readily available and be at hand. Their job is to assemble every piece of data concerning the subject that they want to study, and then presenting that in gargantuan footnotes, usually, along with their various interpretations and the interpretations of other scholars with whom they're disputing or agreeing or whatever the case may be. But the positivist view is fundamentally this. we cannot step beyond the boundaries of the ancient evidence. If we revert to our model of the palace at Versailles, all we can write about is what we can see. If there are wings of the ancient past, if there are wings of the palace of the ancient past that we can't see, then we can't see them. We have to accept that and move on. And positivism was extremely successful in establishing an awful lot of fundamental information about the ancient past, especially when it was focused on the things that the ancient sources are interested in, namely politics and military matters. As long as you were studying the wars of the Romans or the development of the Roman Republic, you had lots of information available to you. And so that the positivistic exercise was very successful for many years, for many decades, and in fact, in some quarters, is still ongoing. However, in the 20th century, and particularly since World War II, a new branch of history emerged, and it can't really be classified in any simple way, so I've just termed it new history. The new history was concerned with writing history from the bottom up. The new history said, if there was a Roman Empire, and we've been looking at the politics and military endeavours of the Romans, we're looking at a minute fraction of the population of the Roman Empire. What's everyone else doing? What are the farmers doing? What's the life of the slave like? What about the woman who's kept indoors? Okay, what about the marginalised brigands, for instance, of Roman society? What about the people who the ancient sources don't write about directly, but who show up from time to time? They're alluded to, they show up in anecdotes, or sometimes they're just assumed to exist, and they may be just assumed to be present in the room. For instance, a slave is assumed to be there at an ancient description of, say, a dinner party. Well, what was the dinner party like from the slaves' perspectives, rather than from the people who were eating the food? This is the sort of question that the new historians, the historians from the bottom up, like to ask. When they came across to try and investigate these subjects, well, lo and behold, they didn't have much evidence. The ancients only wrote about what interested the upper classes, which, as we'll see, is where most of the literature for the ancient world derived from. So what did they do? Well, they fill out the picture. They say, if we can't see whole wings of the Palace of Versailles, let's look at other palaces that we do know about and try and extrapolate. Let's look at comparative data. For instance, if we're studying slaving societies, what do other slaves in other societies feel about their condition? If we've nothing from the ancient Roman slave actually written down, what do other slaves think? We have information from the antebellum South, from slaves in Brazil and so forth. Let's use that. They use sociological and social scientific theory to fill out the picture. Anthropological theory, anthropological analysis of cultures and societies to help fill out the gaps in the ancient evidence. This approach has been extremely successful, and I'd like to read you a quote from one of its best proponents, although he wasn't an ancient historian, he was an historian of modern England, but writes, I think, the best single sentence that summarizes this approach of history from the bottom up and the whole thesis of it. I refer to E.P. Thompson, writer of British history, who in his classic historical work, The Making of the English Working Class, published in 1968, writes, quote, I am seeking to rescue the poor stockinger, the Luddite cropper, the obsolete handloom weaver, the utopian artisan, and even the deluded follower of Joanna Southcott from the enormous condescension of posterity. This is the attitude of the new historian summarized in a nutshell. You could say, I am seeking to rescue the slave, the freedman, the brigand, the poor smallholder of the Roman Republic from the enormous condescension of posterity. The exact same mentality is applied in the study of the ancient past for the new historians who focus on antiquity. So we have positivists, we have the new historians, history from the bottom up, if you like. The most recent and most controversial approach is that adopted by postmodernists. The postmodernist movement, as far as history is concerned, really stems out of a literary critical approach, which emphasizes the nature of the text above everything. It denies the ability of the reader to reconstruct authorial intent and emphasizes only the reader's interpretation of any given text. Be that text the back of a matchbox or Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace, doesn't matter. It's what the reader draws out of the text that's important. This is a literary critical approach, and since history is a text-based discipline, you can imagine it has severe ramifications for the study of the past. A postmodernist historian would deny, for instance, that we can ever reconstruct the past. We cannot get behind the text that we read about the past. Postmodernists talk about constructing history rather than reconstructing it. And how do you construct history? You construct history in your own image. You construct history in the image of your own cultural prejudices, gender biases, racial prejudices, or whatever. And so the act of the postmodernist historian who's coming to enlighten us is to deconstruct the history and show us all our foibles and failings, present a history of the past that really suits the position of the teller of the story. I don't intend to adopt a postmodernist approach or a positivistic approach in this course, so my apologies to positivists and postmodernists who might be watching or listening. I intend instead to adopt broadly the new historical approach. I believe that comparative data and the insights of the social sciences can be very helpful when we come to look at the societal aspects of our subject. For the political and military spheres, we have a lot of ancient evidence about those subjects, so I can adopt a broadly positivistic approach there. But the postmodernist view, I'm afraid, will not be one that's going to be expounded in this course. And just to let you know that the outline I've given you here is really something of a simplification, I can quote to you from the preface of a book written as recently as 1979, a major book entitled The Emperor in the Roman World, a massive study by a man who is now probably the leading Roman historian of his generation, Fergus Miller, sitting in Oxford. And just to show you that positivism and new history and postmodernism all coexist simultaneously, they're foundations for debate among scholars. The issue of the approach to the ancient evidence itself is a focus of debate. As recently as 1979, Fergus Miller could write in the preface to his study of the Emperor in the Roman World, quote, "In preparing the work, I have rigidly avoided reading sociological works on kingship and related topics. Our studies of monarchic institutions on societies other than those of Greece and Rome. I am perfectly conscious that this will have involved considerable losses of percipience and unawareness in whole ranges of questions that I could have asked. Nonetheless, I am confident that the loss in the opposite case would have been greater. For to have come to the subject with an array of concepts derived from the study of other societies would merely have made even more unattainable the proper objective of a historian, to subordinate himself to the evidence and the conceptual world of the society of the past." That's a positivist. That's as neat a summary of the positivistic view as you can have. The view, the purpose of the historian is to subordinate himself to the evidence. So much so for the approaches to the evidence. What is the ancient material like? Well, broadly speaking, it falls into two classes, archaeological and written evidence. Archaeological evidence is defined as any and all physical material from the ancient past. So you can imagine that it encompasses rather a wide array of evidence. I've classified it into macro and micro evidence. Macro elements, forms of evidence, would be entire cities. We have innumerable cities from the ancient world, the most famous probably being Pompeii, buried by Vesuvius in AD 79, buried under mounds of volcanic ash, and Herculaneum, also buried by Vesuvius on the same day, but buried under volcanic mud. But there are cities as well spread all over the Roman Empire. We find cities buried in the sands of Tunisia and Syria, are the remnants of forts and cities and towns in northern England. So the macro evidence would embrace cities and buildings and large artifacts that have been identified through archaeological investigation. Not all of it conducted, by the way, in the best scientific way. I also believe that the macro evidence would include some dramatic evidence, such as, for instance, bodies. Obviously, we get bodies from graves and burials, burials being one of the chief sources of archaeological evidence. But again, from the Vesuvian cities comes incredibly dramatic evidence of people who were killed in the disaster that overtook these places on the 24th of August, AD 79. The excavators, when they were digging through the ash, would occasionally encounter cavities in the ash. And to find out what was in there, they rather cleverly poured plaster of Paris into the cavity, let it set, then excavated around. All kinds of perishable objects, wood, chairs, doors, pieces of furniture would show up, but occasionally they would find Pompeians, Romans, who had perished in the disaster, and some of those finds are extremely dramatic. So really the macro evidence then are the body of evidence that comes from the ancient world that is large and readily identifiable. in certain cases can be particularly dramatic, as from these towns in and around Pompeii and Herculaneum. The microevidence offers us something of a different form, which would be all the bits and pieces that show up in and around the macroevidence as you're activating it. And it's extremely valuable. Undoubtedly, the chief form of evidence here would be pottery. Pottery is fired clay. It's imperishable. It can be smashed into smaller fragments, but it does not biodegrade, and so it survives in the soil for as long as it's in there. And vast quantities of pottery have come up from the ancient world. They've been subjected to extremely close analysis and study and can tell us an awful lot about the ancient economy, trade routes and so forth by studying pottery. If we go back into the very ancient past, we also get analysis of pottery styles and decoration to help identify one culture from the other. So pottery is one of the chief forms of micro evidence, finds, if you like to think of them that way, that crop up from archaeological remains. But we also get textiles and bones. Bones of animals can tell you what sort of herds they had. In very rare occasions can we find textiles, because textiles degrade rapidly. Only in extremely dry or extremely damp conditions do textiles survive. And now, with the extremely profitable marriage of science and archaeology, we can now use microscopes to identify things like pollen, which can also tell you what the grass was like, what particular genus of grass was growing beside the Roman villa, for instance, at this or that time. So the microevidence can really be micro. It can be down to the cellular level when you use electron microscopes. So archaeological excavation is an extremely valuable tool. I must stress, though, that it is essentially a destructive process. When you excavate a site, you are, to all intents and purposes, destroying it. You can't go back and do it again. Once you've excavated the site, you have disrupted the strata and so forth of the site, and it can't be done again. So excavation these days is conducted very carefully, and the key job of all archaeologists is to publish their findings, because without the publication of their findings, all that data dies with them, and no one ever knows what they found there. Archaeological evidence is incredibly useful for identifying what the physical environment of the ancient world was like, but its chief drawback is that it is mute. It's only valuable when it's interpreted. A pot is a pot is a pot. But when it's interpreted, when it's analyzed and put together with other evidence to construct trading patterns, then it tells us something about the ancient past. But the evidence itself is mute. And as I like to say, if you excavate a Roman villa, that's well and good. We can look at the ground plan of the villa, identify the bathing rooms, the dining rooms, and the sleeping cubicles and so forth. What we can't tell are what were the hopes and dreams of the people who lived in the villa. What did they believe? How did they look at the world? What stories did they tell their children at night? We can't tell any of that from the archaeological evidence. For that sort of information, you have to go to the written evidence. And luckily, in the study of ancient Rome, we have a large body, albeit circumscribed, a large body of written evidence. As I said in the first lecture, it's still not as large as it once was, but it's still a fairly significant amount. Written evidence can be subdivided broadly into two categories again. Ancient literature and inscriptions are what's termed epigraphic material. Ancient literature is that body of data that has survived over the centuries from the end of antiquity to the modern era, usually by being copied by monks, overwhelmingly, in the Middle Ages. It comprises a large, vast array of genres. We have all kinds of poetry, epic, elegy, love poetry, pastoral poetry. We have all kinds of letters, correspondence between people, speeches, of course, works written by the ancients about their own history. So we have works of history written by the ancients as well, which are of primary importance for our interest in this course. But you also have a wide variety of other styles, genres, plays, genres of literature. All of that gives us insight, when it's interpreted properly, it gives us insight into the lives of the ancients, into how they viewed the world. And so it's invaluable, especially as a supplement to the archaeological evidence, invaluable. When one uses written and archaeological evidence together, the results can be spectacular. On the other hand, the material has survived in copy form. Often our very earliest texts of this or that author will date only to maybe the 13th or 14th or even 15th centuries. And as a result, to a certain degree, it isn't pure chance that has allowed these manuscripts to survive. It's because they've been selected. To a certain degree, they've been selected by the people who copied them. Something of value was seen in them, and so it was worth the laborious job of copying out these ancient manuscripts and passing them down from generation to generation. So to a certain degree, that's a selected body of text. Not entirely. I mean, the vicissitudes of chance still apply, but to a certain degree, it's definitely a selected body of data. When we turn to the other main body of written evidence from the ancient world, inscriptions, this is not the case. Inscriptions speak to us directly from the ancient past. Inscriptions are a class of data that are invaluable for looking at the ancient world. They're carved on stone, or in metal, or in bone, or they're written on proto-paper called papyrus. Sometimes they're written on coins, as we'll see at the end of this lecture. But they contain an enormous variety of information in themselves. If you were to think, what's the most common type of inscription that exists in the modern world? Well, it's the epitaph. Here lies Uncle Joe, R.I.P. Well, the same is true for the inscriptions from the ancient world, from the Latin-speaking world. Epitaphs comprise perhaps 70%, maybe 80% of our epigraphic data from the Roman past. Unlike rather terse epitaphs of the modern age, they can be, however, extremely fulsome and give us lots of information about the person that they're writing about, especially if that person has taken part in public life. Usually all the offices that that person had will be listed. So, again, you can imagine when collated, assembled, and studied quantitatively, they can prove extremely useful. But besides epitaphs, there are also all kinds of other inscriptions that the ancients put up. Treaties. They would put up laws, tables of laws pertaining to this or that town. They would put up commemorative inscriptions. X built this bathhouse, Y restored this portico. They would put up inscriptions that accompanied honorary statues of important people. Here's a statue of this great guy from our local community. Why? Well, because he gave all this money for a public banquet or whatever. So you've got honorary and commemorative inscriptions of all sorts. And you also have interesting texts that are letters. Letters from important people to backwood, nowhere type places. If the emperor takes notice of your town for whatever reason, that's just the sort of thing that you commission to have carved on stone and stuck up in the forum of your town. Look, the emperor has taken notice of our little town. So we can get imperial documents of all sorts as well carved on stone. Inscriptions as well extend to the more varied and less formal form. In extraordinary circumstances, we can have inscriptions that are painted on walls. Inscriptions that are either pieces of graffiti, and there are some of them I could quote, but they're actually unquotable, because just like modern bathroom graffiti, they aren't the subtlest of messages. But also from Pompeii, a very interesting body of data that we wouldn't have otherwise really surmised existed, are election, local election notices. The equivalent of our election posters painted on the walls outside houses. Vote for this guy for the local mayorship, because he's a good guy. And what I find a very amusing one, a real sign of how these inscriptions can tell you the Romans were people too, you have anti-election notices. The thieves of Pompeii recommend that you vote for this guy, because we know him to be efficient at his job. Unlike the literary material, inscriptions speak to us directly from the past. They have not been selected. They have not been copied. They turn up often in archaeological finds. Sometimes they've been reused. You can find them built into later walls. Sometimes they were reused even in the ancient past. If a later culture came through and wanted to build a fort, and there was a Roman town nearby, well, why go quarry all the stone? You have a Roman town, just take the stone down. And often some of those stones can be inscribed, and you'll go along and you'll find an inscription built into a medieval wall or into a medieval church or cathedral. Very, very, very striking evidence. That is, striking for the continuity between the ancient and the medieval world. But inscriptions can be found in all sorts of contexts, not just dug up in scientific archaeological excavation. The ancient written evidence, however, does have its limitations. In the case of literature, it's all written by men. It's all written by men who lived mostly in Rome. I think of the size of the empire. It's all written by men who came from a certain class. No male slaves wrote anything that we have that has survived. And very, very few women. What's more, it's mostly written between the period 200 BC and AD 200. most Roman literature falls within that chronological bracket. So it's a very focused body of material that addresses the interests of upper class males living in Rome in this 400 year period. Inscriptions likewise are largely formulaic, while epitaphs and laws and election notices can be all very informative, they're nonetheless a certain style of evidence. They're a certain class of material. They tend to use the same sort of language again and again and again. An honorary inscription commemorating the erection of a building will have the same sort of formulae again and again, whether it's found in Syria or whether it's found in Scotland or whether it's found in France or Germany. You have the same sort of data. It's not like you're suddenly going to find an inscription that is the life story of the Emperor Claudius carved on stone. That's not what's going to turn up. So again, it's limited. It's valuable, but it's limited. I want to close with two odd types of ancient evidence that are in a class really unto themselves, and that would be coins and papyrus. Coins, especially Roman imperial coins, are the model for our modern coins. They had on one side the head of the ruler, usually with an inscription around the side of the head saying what a great guy he was, identifying him in all his titles, and so they can be dated very precisely. And on the other side, on the side opposite the head, they would often have propaganda messages, usually saying what a wonderful place the Roman Empire is to live in and what a good job Emperor X is doing of ruling it. So coins are sort of quasi-archaeological, quasi-written material all at once. They can be studied as archaeological artifacts in and of themselves, or they can be read as texts. And papyrus is an even odder form of data, which derives from extremely dry or extremely wet conditions. It's the form of ancient paper, really, written in ink. Probably the most famous collection of papyri being the Dead Sea Scrolls from the ancient past, a rather unique find. But again, a very rare form of evidence and demanding a high degree of specialized skill in reading them. So that's the value, and that's the body of ancient material, wide-ranging, broad, but nonetheless limited, and always open to varying interpretation.
Lecture 3, Pre-Roman Italy and the Etruscans.
Welcome to the third lecture in the history of ancient Rome. Having surveyed the introductory materials in the first two lectures, it's now time to turn our attention to the ancient world itself. What I intend to do in this lecture is set the situation as it existed in pre-Roman Italy. The Romans were not the first people to inhabit the Italian peninsula. They weren't even the first people to become powerful or influential within the Italian peninsula. And it's worth examining what the situation was that the Romans felt when they emerged as a major power in the region in the 4th and 3rd centuries BC. I will begin by looking at the overall geography of the Italian peninsula and how it benefited the ancient inhabitants there. And then we will examine in sequence the non-urbanized tribal cultures of pre-Roman Italy, the Greek colonists in the southern part of Italy and in Sicily. We will treat them fairly briefly, mind you. And then we will look at the people who were often erroneously described as so mysterious, the Etruscans, who aren't really all that mysterious at all, as we'll see. First, however, the geography of the Italian peninsula as a whole. Italy is very well watered because of its mountainous nature. In the north are the towering Alpine ranges, which are perennially snowbound and so offer plenty of rivers and streams to the northern part of the peninsula. But down the spine of Italy, if you want to think of Italy as the boot, which is certainly the way that I was told, always think of Italy as the boot kicking Sicily, which I think is metaphorically really quite accurate. But down the spine of Italy are the Apennine Mountains. They're not as high as the Alps. They're not permanently snowbound, but they do offer, especially in the wintertime, an abundance of water, streams and springs to feed the inhabitants. The largest rivers in Italy, at least the ones that we're going to be most focused on, are three. The Po River in the north, which runs from east to west, sort of from Milan over towards Venice. The Arno River in north-central Italy, which we'll see was one of the borders of the ancient Etruscan homeland. And then in central Italy, the Tiber River, which is the river upon which Rome was founded. The mountainous nature of Italy also offered the people plenty of wood and pasture land for sheep and goats, which were raised in great profusion, as archaeology makes clear, and still are to this day.